Ireland may be a small island on the edge of a continent, but our unique mix of animals and plants gives us a fascinating natural history. This series celebrates the animals that share our island, and we meet some of the people who know them best. I'm Colin Stackard-Johnson, and this is Nature on One. In this series, we've explored some of Ireland's offshore islands, its woodlands, enjoyed nature in our wetlands, and even our cities. But this week, we're going deep underground to discover the hidden wildlife of Irish caves. We're going to look at the creatures that frequent this underground world and reveal some of the secrets that caves tell us about our past landscape. I'm here at Dunmore Cave, 11 kilometres north of Kilkenny City. This is the only large cave in this part of the country, and it's the site of a wildlife event that's only recently been discovered. In autumn, large numbers of bats are gathering inside this cave, and they're engaging in long flight periods together. Now, we know that bats sometimes hibernate in caves over winter, but last year, this autumnal swarming was recorded in this cave for the very first time. And tonight, I'm going to meet up with Ireland's best-known bat specialist, Conor Kelleher, and I'm hoping to witness this autumnal swarming. Now it's about 10 o'clock, and it's a fairly mild night. The rain seems to have eased off, so potentially it could be a good bat night. It's quite cool. You just, as you walk into the cave itself, and that's what I'm doing now, just literally moving away, leaving the plant life behind, and the air has suddenly become dramatically cooler. So we're in the first chamber of the cave called the main hall, and I've seen my first bat fly by. Now all the bats flying into the cave system will fly through this entrance chamber. So we have got, 10 species of bats in Ireland. And what are the main ones that are coming here?
The main ones that are coming here are natterer's bats. We've got a few other species here, like long-eared bats and Dobbinton's bats as well. But they wouldn't be in the same numbers as the natterer's bats.
There is a few flying around now. They have not been here sort of during the day. They're all flying to this cave from the surrounding area.
Exactly that, yeah. We don't know what distance they're coming from, but it could be, you know, quite considerable, tens of kilometres away. So at this time of night, now they've already had their nightly feed, so their bellies are full. So they start thinking of other things, then maybe mating or socialising with friends, and they've had time to make the distance and the journey from wherever their normal foraging site and roosting site is to the cave. So they've taken a couple of hours to get here after they've finished feeding. So the first ones are just starting to arrive now at this time of night.
And it seems to me, it's almost like some sort of ancient gathering of the clans or something. It's like this, there's this landmark that somehow they all know. I mean, people think of bats as being little, you know, little blind animals that flutter around, but they know their landscape intimately.
They do, because they've been on the planet a lot longer than we have, and they've been using sites like this for millennia. And also, on top of that, they're actually very intelligent, long-lived animals. For instance, these little fellows here, now we know they can live up to 20 years or beyond, maybe up into their 40s. So this wouldn't be the first time they're coming here. They could be coming here for the last 35 years. So they know the countryside between here and wherever their normal roosting sites are, and they'd pass that on to the newer generations by being kind of instructors or mentors to the smaller ones, and they'd follow their parent, their mother. The father doesn't take any interest in the raising of the offspring. So the young one would stay with the mother for a year or two until he's learned all the colony's roosting areas. And this is like a big clan gathering, because it's a bit mysterious at the minute, because we don't see them actually mating in sites like this. It may have something to do with mating, but most of the ones that are actually coming here are males, so we don't exactly know what the purpose of this clan gathering is, you call it. It seems to be a socialising thing, but what its exact purpose is, we just don't know, either here or in Britain, why it's after happening like that. But you get literally hundreds of bats congregating, wasting energy, zipping around, flying around, and it doesn't make any sense to us, because they're burning off the fuel supply that will last them through the winter months when they have to hibernate. So it's a bit mysterious that they're going to the effort of making the journey to places like this, using up vital resources in flight around these places for no apparent reason. So there must be a reason for it, but we just don't know what it is.
And how are we going to track them down?
Well, we'll use a bat detector.
So how does that work? Because the sound a bat makes, or most of the sounds they make, are above our level of hearing, aren't they?
Exactly.
So yeah. The bat detector, how is that actually working? It's the sound that we're hearing on this, we're going to hear, is not the sound that they actually make as
no,
such.
No, we have no real idea what the bat sound actually sounds like. What we're listening to is an artificial sound created by a little ultrasound pocket-sized machine, which really is just a fairly simple device electronically. It takes in the sound of the bat at a high frequency through a microphone. It does a little bit of electronic wizardry in the middle, and then it gives out a much lower frequency repetition of the sound down at our hearing range so as we can hear it. So we can hear about 18 kilohertz. Anything above that is beyond our hearing range. And these bats are calling around 45, 50 kilohertz, or anywhere between 30 and 110 kilohertz, to be honest.
Depending on the species, because each species has a different call.
That's right, yeah. We've noticed they all make different sounds in that. But this particular one, it's so quiet in that, plus it's much higher than our hearing range, that there's no way we can hear this species without one of these little devices.
Do you want to turn it on and see if there's anything?
If there's anything about... There's a background hiss on this, but that's normal with the machine. You can just hear the little tiny clicks of the animal then as they pass by you. That's one of them there now.
Oh, yeah.
But they're flying around our heads here, and until I turned it on, we weren't aware of them. So they're quite secret, and in darkness like this, they'll be around you, and you just won't know about it. They won't get caught in your hair like the old wives' tales say they do or anything. They avoid us, really. But once you turn on one of these machines, it really brings the life of the bats and the bat world to life. And they've really revolutionised the study of bats, because they've helped us to actually tell the different species apart. Even if we can't see them in darkness, we can use the sounds and we know exactly which species we're dealing with.
Amazing. Can I turn on my torchlight a minute?
You can indeed, yeah.
Oh, look at that. 2, 3, 4, 5... They're chasing each other.
They're zipping around in pairs, some of them.
Oh, yeah.
So you get buzzed by them fairly often right next to you, like, you know, and they're so loud on this. But if we turn this thing off now, we're only really aware that they're here with the lights and the bat detector. If we turn off the lights and turn off the bat detector, you'll see how silent it is, and you just have no idea that these animals are around us at all.
But what's really amazing is, as you say, when you stand at the pitch dark and all you can hear really is the dripping water, you would have no idea that there could now be hundreds of animals flying around in this cave, all screaming, but we just can't hear it.
Exactly, yeah. It's a good job we can hear it, because we won't be able to sleep or relax in our beds at night with the racket outside the window, because some of these bats are up to 110 decibels, which is like a jet aircraft when it's taking off. So very, very loud creatures indeed.
But just as well we can't hear them. We've been here for a couple of hours now, and we've just moved into the cave system, down a narrow passage and into another chamber. And the numbers are certainly building in here. Even without a light or the bat detector on, you can just sense slight movement by your head every now and again as the bats sort of zip by. You can hear the flutter of their wings. What amazing flyers down here in the pitch dark, and they know exactly where I am. Oh, look, see this little sort of a crevice over there? That's what they call the crystal pool. And it's like that's only about a foot wide and a foot high. There are bats flying in and out of that. Yeah. So there could be lots of things happening sort of behind closed doors, as it were.
Yeah, and they could be skimming the top surface of that pool of water now, just get a drink for themselves as well. While they're on the wing, they just dip in like a swallow would do and take a little mouthful and carry on. So it could be that as well. They like mirrored surfaces. They're able to pick up a direct location that it's actually a water body. And they just dip down and take a drink out of it as they're flying by. But it goes beyond the pool back there into a smaller chamber. Like, so two of them just came out of...
Yes, yes.
They're chasing each other.
Really, there's a lot of bats down here now.
There are, yeah.
Oh, look. That's like a real little hot spot, isn't it?
It is, yeah. They're zipping in and out. They could be perching in there now. chit-chattering to each other, which is an audible sound that we don't need a detector for. We can hear them chittering and chattering with our own ears.
They're sort of social calls.
Exactly, yeah. And in some species, they've isolated up to 40 different sounds bats make, and they've recorded them and played them back to the bats, and each sounds of the sounds will actually get a different reaction from the bats, so they're actually instructions, we're leaving tonight, or where the best feeding site is, and that, like, so they do have a kind of a social language amongst them. It's like a hive of bees, really, you know, the bee dance, where the bees instruct each other where the food is, and that. Well, bats manage to be able to communicate as well, because in some cases, like Natter's bats, we've had them in roosts of maybe 200, and they'd be there for several weeks during the summer months. And then if you count them each night, on one particular night, it could be Tuesday or Wednesday, they all leave as normal. But when you wait there for dawn to come back, none of them come back. And they must have agreed that that was the night they were all leaving, you know. So how do they organise themselves like that? So they're a very complex, kind of a gregarious, social animal species, and they do have some form of communication amongst themselves.
And why are caves so popular with bats?
It's the feature that's been there the longest, really, geologically in time. So they're not going to change without, say, man interfering, or they're a very slow rate of change. So from generation to generation of bats, there isn't going to be a lot of environmental change down there. But they offer a bat a very stable temperature. They're looking for temperatures of maybe 5 or 6 degrees to while away the winter months in hibernation.
I think a lot of people will be amazed that they live for so long, because people often refer to bats as being like flying mice, but they're a much more complicated, complex animal, aren't they?
They are. It's a shame, really, that they have furry mouse-like bodies and just mouse-like ears, because in every other respect, they're very similar to ourselves. They're flying with their hands, and they use their wings rather like an extension of their arms, really. There's a double thickness of skin stretched between their finger bones, and they can use them for flight, as we know, like the birds do. But unlike birds that have a very stiff wing with bones and feathers on it, the bat can move his hands and his fingers just like we can. So by doing that, they can alter the shape of their wing, which means the way the wind or the air passes over and under it is altered. So it means they're much more acrobatic in the air than the birds are. So they can fly vertically and hover in one spot. They can do loop-de-loops and that, which the birds can't manage. But also because they're flying with their hands, they can use their hands just like we would to grab food as well. So they won't just use them as wings. They'll actually pick insects out of the air with them and then quickly put them into their mouths as well while they're in flight. Like, you know. So they're very versatile in animals that way.
I've always been amazed at how many insects an individual bat can eat in a night.
It's quite phenomenal, really, because they put on half their body weight each night, and that equates to about maybe 600 midges per hour per bat, or maybe up to 3,000 to 3,500 insects per night. And that's each bat each night. And the reason they can afford to do that and put on half their body weight is because they're constantly burning energy, and it's very calorifically expensive when they're in flight. So they're constantly burning the energy off. So they can burn off that extra half a body weight each night and turn it into a little bit of brown fat between their shoulder blades, which is their fuel supply for the winter then. But it would be like us going from 8 stone to 12 stone after we've had our breakfast. So it's quite large that way from our point of view. Or you can imagine sitting down and eating 20 breakfast rolls or something at a sitting. Like, well, bats do that every night of the week. Like, and so.
Yeah, we have to get the old treadmill after that, eh?
You would need to burn that off. But, I mean, their heart rate goes up to about 800 beats a minute when they're in flight. So you can imagine their circulation is zipping around their body at a phenomenal rate. And that's one of the reasons they don't come out during daylight hours, because the night air is cooler and their wings act like radiators to cool themselves down from all this excess heat that they're producing. So they're able to maintain their flight while not overheating, which is not the case if they were out by day in the scorching sun. They'd die a heat stroke. Plus, they'd be picked
off. Heat stroke in Ireland. Yeah. That theory might work in other countries, but yeah, I know what you mean.
On the odd day that it shines. But they'd be picked off by the birds as well, so they're better off at night time when they've disguised to themselves.
Should we move on to another chamber and just see...
Yeah, because this, I mean, the numbers that are in here might be replicated in other chambers,
exactly.
Or they might be even more somewhere else.
Okay, now Connor's just going to see if he can actually catch one of these Natter's bats. He's got something that, for all the world, looks like a sort of a butterfly net. And what he's hoping to do is find one hanging little crevice. Do you get one, Colin?
Yeah, I got one.
Just put these down.
Ah, look. He's hidden totally in your hand.
He is, yeah. They're small enough just to fit in the palm of my hand. Yeah. He's fairly docile now, so he's fairly quiet at the minute because he's probably just having a relaxing rest after his night's exertions. And he's actually cold to the touch now with the rock that he was lying on. He's absorbed the heat or the coldness from the rock, so he's fairly torpid at the minute.
And but that is an Atteras?
An Atteras, yeah.
Yeah.
You can tell that by the length of his ears. They protrude beyond the nose. He's got a bare, kind of a bald, pinkish face, if you look at him, very long muzzle as well.
Yeah, yeah.
As you can see, the main identification feature of these, apart from the ears, would be this fringe of hairs just along the back of the tail membrane.
Oh, they're tiny little hairs, aren't they?
Yeah, they're like little tiny half-size eyelashes, really, really stiff hairs. But they fringe the back of the tail membrane here, so they can grab the spiders out of their webs.
He's very soft too, isn't he? Now, he's opening his mouth, so he is probably calling away, is he? But we just can't hear him.
You can't hear him, no. They're above our hearing. He's very long, thin muzzle as well, so you can see all the tiny teeth in there, but they're only 1 millimetre in size. And he's got a gap at the front. There's no teeth at the front of his muzzle as well, because remember, he's producing these sounds out through his mouth, so if he had teeth at the very front, they'd probably block the sounds coming out. So he has a gap in the middle, like, you know.
Yeah.
So.
He looks fairly battered and scarred over the years.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing to think this guy could be, you know, 19, 20 years old now, like, you know, so he could be coming to this cave for the last 20-odd years. We just don't know how old they are once they get to this stage, because we can tell how old they are up to about 3 months old because of the ossification of the bones and the wings, and in case of Dob Benton's...
If you hold out that wing and you shine the light through it...
That's right, yes,
you can see. Can you hear? Hold on. You want to put the light in the back of that?
If you just spread out one wing.
Oh, you
just
can see
do one
the hand.
Wing at a time, Nick. You can actually see the blood vessels straight away with all the veins and everything.
Well, I suppose you don't want to hold on to him for too long.
No, because he's torpid. He's actually warming up now as he's standing in my hand, so he's absorbing the heat from my hand and he's getting more active, so he's stretching his wings now, ready to go.
His ears are going.
Yeah, he's actually sensing his surroundings to see where he actually is, so he's not going to fly straight off into a wall or anything like that. He's off and away. He's gone.
Fabulous.
Caves also have a story to tell about our past, as they hold so many ancient treasures, including animal remains. Nigel Monaghan is curator of the Natural History Museum in Dublin, where many of these bones found in Irish caves are now stored. So Nigel, why are caves such great repositories for animal bones?
Well, the advantage in Ireland comes from our geology. We have limestone geology over a lot of the country. A lot of people will be familiar with that. And it can have caves in it, as people will see in the classic caving areas where you can go and see show caves in the Burren or up in Marble Arch in Fermanagh or somewhere. Those caves extend over a lot of the Irish bedrock. And in the Ice Age, they would have been places where the sediment didn't get wiped away by the ice. So in fact, we'd have probably had sites with woolly mammoth and animals like giant deer all over the countryside. But as the ice comes along in the next phase of the Ice Age, it wipes that neighbourhood clean of sediment. And the one place where sediment tends to accumulate, complete with animal bones, is in caves. And of course, that's there for us to study tens of thousands of years later.
You found evidence of what sorts of animals having had a historical past here?
Well, the obvious ones that you'd expect in an Ice Age landscape would be the giant deer, which is a familiar thing that people will see hanging on stately home walls and standing in hallways like our museum. But we also have remains of woolly mammoth, brown bear, and slightly more unexpected animals, perhaps like spotted hyena.
How come, some of these animals I can see, well, bears I can see how they might end up in caves as they hibernate. But things like, what's known as the Irish elk, what were they doing in the cave?
They didn't choose to be in the cave. There were a couple of animals that did choose to be in caves. Bears, we know, hibernate. Hyenas, we know, use caves to den and to protect their young when they're rearing them to a certain stage before they start living mostly in the open. But the other animals, woolly mammoth, giant deer, and a lot of the other animals we find, would have fallen into those caves. If you imagine an area like the Burren today we're intelligent primates. We walk around looking for problems and we keep our children away from the edge of dangerous things. Animals wouldn't have been perhaps quite as careful or as successful in doing that. And also they'd have been trying to get the vegetation, the nice lush vegetation growing around the opening, so they could easily tumble into the cave or occasionally be brought in by carnivores. But animals like woolly mammoths were probably just falling through holes in the roof.
The people who excavated these bones, did they then just send them to the Natural History Museum, or were they in private collections that you then sort of got at the end of their lives or something? Or how did you come to have all this?
Well, our earliest material dates from the mid-19th century. In the 1850s, a particular cave near Dungarvan was discovered. Local workmen were crushing up the limestone from the neighbourhood to spread on the roads after a rough winter. And they broke through into a cave and they discovered large bones, brought them into the town of Dungarvan, and the postmaster, Edward Brennan, and some other people sent those bones up to the Royal Dublin Society. And that's how the first Irish cave remains came to be in our museum.
So how did Edward Brennan, for example, explain the bones in this cave? What did he think?
Well, the people he got the bones from, the local workmen, were describing them as the bones of giants. But Brennan probably had a better education and had an idea that these were fossils of some ancient animals. And he described in his own article in the Royal Dublin Society publication how these were the bones of woolly mammoth and brown bear and things that he was being told by the curator of the museum. Brennan's interpretation ended with, of course, this had to be the flood that exterminated these animals, and that's why you don't find them in Ireland today. Whereas the curator's approach was not to wander into that sort of religious territory that had been quite common at the time and just simply to describe the facts in sort of true scientific detail.
So you've got all these little drawers and then some big drawers containing larger specimens underneath.
Yeah, and if we pull these out, we're seeing large examples of bears. In some of these cupboards, we actually have fairly large items, and here are some bear skulls.
Ah.
And this is the biggest bear skull ever found in Ireland.
Wow.
And it's longer than my forearm.
Hey, hold it for a moment. Oh, yeah.
They grew to be very large animals. I mean, if you imagine the largest grizzly bears, which are basically the same species as the brown bears we had in Ireland, they were huge. They were more than four times your body weight, much taller and very, very powerful around the chest muscle and arms. And mainly with a lot of these animals, they kill their food by hitting it. They don't actually jump on you and bite you. They tend to actually hit a lot of their food. They've got very large hands, very powerful long arms, and good claws. And when you hold something well with your claws, it doesn't get to get away. They were very much hunters, but they were also gatherers. And they would have spent a lot of their time browsing and eating berries and fruits and nuts. People are probably aware that they're very good fishermen. So they go scooping into the water with these big claws and fishing out salmon. And you can imagine what Ireland's rivers must have been like at the time. It must have been a paradise for these guys in the autumn.
So it strikes me just from talking to you that although you're surrounded by all these sort of dead animals, that your mind is very much thinking of living ones. You see, when you look at these dead bones, you almost reconstruct the living thing from them.
Yeah, I mean, that is the point, and that's the point of paleontology as a subject, is actually trying to reconstruct the whole environment using the scraps of evidence that you get. One of the things we've been able to do with our bears is extract DNA. We haven't been able to get the whole string of DNA, but we've got long enough strings to be able to match them up. And one of the most interesting things that we discovered in the last few years looking at that bear DNA was that an essence of that bear DNA is found in every single modern living polar bear. And that's because they all share a common ancestor with some of our brown bears. The polar bears off the coast of Ireland, when the Atlantic Ocean this far south had ice sheets, and you had polar bears out hunting the way that you'd imagine them today, and they were meeting brown bears on the island of Ireland, and they were interbreeding. And there's an element of their DNA preserves that story to today.
That's amazing. Just how you can get so much information from these carefully labelled boxes all those years ago.
Well, we're now down a few cupboards further on and we're looking at woolly mammoth remains from a cave in County Cork. And it was a very productive cave. We got hyena, woolly mammoth, giant deer, brown bear, wolves, and a whole pile of different species from this cave. And it's also the cave that's produced some of the oldest material in Ireland. And because of that, it goes back far enough to include woolly mammoth, and that's what's in this drawer. I'll just pull that out. So the reason we know this is the solid evidence of mammoths in Ireland is pieces of tooth and bone here. And if you look at this piece here, which is almost defies description, so I'll give it to you to describe.
Oh, if I was to, it almost looks like a broken up bee's nest or something initially. I don't know what it is. It looks like something that's been damaged to me.
It's the aero bar, if you like, of the mammal world. And this is a piece of skull bone from an elephant, or a woolly mammoth in this case. And yet it's relatively light. A lot of the elephant bones generally, including the woolly mammoth, the bone is not the only part of the structure that holds the animal together. Their muscles are so massive. Their bones, although they're big, are actually relatively light. And some of them have quite a lot of hollow space inside and have more of an egg carton structure in order to make large bone without using up too much material and without becoming too heavy. And we have teeth of varying sizes right up to full adult, but including a lot of smaller ones. So we have female family groups of mammoths looking after their young, walking through certainly the southern counties of Ireland 30,000 years ago.
It's hard to imagine what Ireland must have looked like and sounded like. You know, all these mammals that you described, the hyenas would have been calling, and whatever mammoths do, I don't know if they rumble or trumpet, but it's extraordinary just to think of it now, isn't it, how it's changed.
I can imagine that if you're out in a tent, polar exploring, heading as far north as Ireland 30,000 years ago, it must have been a very strange place.
Can imagine. It's remarkable.
Having witnessed a live wildlife display like the bats swarming at Dunmore Cave, it's great to see animals continuing to use one of the few untouched landscape features in Ireland, as they have done for millennia. As we've changed so much of this land, evidence of past landscapes that once existed in Ireland have been wiped away, but caves somehow hold the secrets to that ancient Ireland, a country with wild creatures that feels a million miles away from the tame pastures of today.